I go to the bank, see if I get a loan for next day's gas station. Sell more. And I thought my name was Selmore.
They have lottery cards now. You stick in the gas pump, so you...
Yeah, we're all...
Not pay less, is it?
Good afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Department Veterans Budget Division to order. It's about 10 minutes after 4 on Monday, February 2nd. We don't have a quorum yet, but expect to in the very near future. So I'm going to welcome everybody to our first formal hearing. I think we have met once before and had a successful field trip out to the vet's home, and saw a big piece of the budget and the affairs of the veterans of the state of Minnesota. So that was great. We have two new members on our committee, and neither are here yet. I don't expect Senator Claussen today, but Senator Greg Claussen and Senator Patrice Torres-Rae are our two new members. And we'll look forward to having them here. Okay. I also, around the table, we have some familiar faces, Mitch Berger, committee administrator, as well as Stephanie James and Mr. Lundeen is our two staff and counsel, and they, as always, will do an excellent job. And then my new L.A., Bill Lunzer, over here on my immediate right. You'll be hearing from him throughout the year, and we'll look forward to that. So I guess in terms of the old hands here, of course, we have Senator Dames and Senator Anderson, as well as Senator Metzen. Thank you all for coming, and I guess the only thing I'd say is it appears as last year that we'll probably appropriate right around $1 billion. Our work needs to be completed by just after the Passover break, Easter break, which is April 24th. Right now we're going to just go over some changes that in the governor's bill that may affect the way we think about our bill. We have about 25 other bills that will be coming before the committee. And so with that, I think that we're going to start out with Commissioner Mossman from the Department of Administration. And he's going to come up and state his name for the record. And you have in front of you the administration's... Mr. Mossman, you're going to do a 5-minute overview, and then you're going to do the changes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. Okay. Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration, will do a little overview and then walk through the changes. I believe that we've handed out the PowerPoint as opposed to using the overhead. So. And Mr. Chair and members, you're ready to get started. Thank you for having us this afternoon. We're happy to come before you and have the opportunity to present the governor's budget recommendations. As we get started, I'm going to ask Mr. Shearer to introduce himself, and we'll just give you just a very brief overview of the department so that you have a little bit of context for understanding the recommendations that we're going to put before you this afternoon, and then we'll work from there.
Welcome, Mr. Shearer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Matt Shearer, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration. And for the next few minutes, I'll be sort of working off of this sheet right here, which is a brief kind of a summary document for the department. As you're probably aware, you know, our mission is to provide the best value in government services. And we do this in a lot of ways, but principally we do this in a couple of different fashions. First is through kind of customer satisfaction in working with a lot of our different agencies to provide them with valuable results. Also then continuous improvement in employee engagement. But, you know, by the numbers, we do have 15 different business units and approximately 460 full-time equivalent employees. And our various units do a number of different tasks for state government, but principally we are the primary procurement agents for the state of Minnesota, handling over $2.1 billion in goods and services purchases each year. We also oversee the 22 state-owned buildings in the Capitol complex here and provide leasing services to every agency throughout the state in areas outside of the metro area as well. And we manage 400 construction projects, and we insure $12 billion worth of state property and have a fleet of over 2,000 vehicles. And to give you kind of just a brief glimpse of our budget, we have about a $355 million total budget. Of that, $18.9 million is general fund, $28.8 million is made up of grants, federal and pass-through funds, and approximately $307 million is through fees for service. And a lot of those are examples of that are the rent that is paid from the Capitol complex. Agencies make transfers to our agency to help manage their fleet services and also in purchasing goods and services for other agencies.
Excuse me, Mr. Sherry. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then beyond that, on the back side of the sheet, there's a couple of items that I think we as an agency are really particularly proud of. And these are ways in which either we've saved money or saved efficiencies for the state of Minnesota. And I just wanted to point your attention to them. It's a graph on the bottom. But in the last biennium, we had $49 million that we were able to negotiate in savings on government contracts through our procurement division. We had a 21.2% reduction in energy consumption in the 22 buildings in the state capitol. And we also had a 13.6% reduction in gasoline usage in the state fleet. And one final note, too, that I forgot to mention earlier is that we were able to sell 5,000 lots of state property and return over $10.8 million to state agencies. And so with that brief overview, I'd be happy to turn it back over to Commissioner Mossman for the duration of the presentation.
Mr.
Any questions? Senator Madsen?
Well, I just think, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure the analysis has been done. Like, we own 22 state-owned buildings, and we lease 700 buildings. I suppose you could convince me why it makes a lot more sense to lease than to own.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen. Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen. We own substantially more buildings than that. The 22 buildings are the buildings that are directly managed by the Department of Administration as the custodial care for those buildings. We do not, for example, manage directly the state-owned buildings that the Department of Human Services has or the Department of Natural Resources might operate throughout the state. So we do manage all of the leases for the state, so those two numbers are not an apples-to-apples comparison.
I understand. Yeah, I think I get it. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if one of you gentlemen could answer this question. We show $49 million negotiated in savings of state contracts. What comparison model are you using to show you're saving $49 million? Is it similar contracts from the previous 2 years that you reduce the cost of in $49 million, or just how are we coming up with that $49 million savings?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Doms, thank you for the question. It is a comparison of responses to solicitation comes in, and oftentimes, depending upon what the market looks like, we may negotiate for a lower price than what has come in the solicitations.
Other questions? Okay, Mr. Mossman, continue,
Mr.
please.
Chair and members, thank you. I'm going to walk through. You have a couple of sets of documents. You no doubt have the individual budget change items that the Department of Management and Budget provides, and we also have a PowerPoint presentation that I am going to broadly follow from. Also, Mr. Shearer gave an overview of the department, which also reflects on the first eight slides of that presentation. So, if you will, I'm going to jump to page 5 of the PowerPoint presentation and begin walking through the budget recommendations. Mr. Chair and members, just for the sake of context, Minnesota works for sure to be a committed leader in terms of providing economic opportunities for all of its citizens. And we are faced, nonetheless, with some startling economic disparities. Certainly, unemployment rates can be 2 to 4 times for non-white groups in Minnesota as they are for our white citizens. The recommendations, one of the premier sets of recommendations that we bring before you today is to take a look at how the targeted group programs, the veterans preference programs, the programs for economically disadvantaged portions of the state are operating, and to make improvements in those programs to do what we can through the state procurement process to help facilitate reductions in disparities in state procurements, and also by doing that, to do our part to help make sure that opportunities are provided to close broader economic disparities that exist. So, Mr. Chair and members, with that, I'm going to just touch base on our first budget recommendation, the one that's at the front of your package from M&B. Yes, as Mitch is holding up there, thank you. That recommendation is for a 1.8% general increase across the board in our general fund appropriation to continue services that we, our core services that we provide at the Department of Minnesota, at the Department of Administration. So this is a base budget increase to deliver core services that will provide the best value in government services going forward, and to continue the public direct services that we provide and do so appropriately as well. Mr. Chair and members, I want to actually show you a quick, you know, one of the things is I am actually going to backtrack a little bit to the PowerPoint presentation has on the second page. It's actually slide 3 in the PowerPoint presentation. One of the things about the Department of Administration is we certainly are a central service agency in terms of most of our customers, and most of the work that we do is supporting the work of other state agencies. But we also have a beach across state government that we would like to point out. This map here is just an initial effort by the department to try and give some sense by county across the state of how, when you look at the local governments and other individuals who pursue either opinions from our iPad division through the Data Practices Act, or technology assistive technology services through our STAR program, work with the Developmental Disabilities Council, our Office of Grants Management, or other functions that we work with, not to mention where some of our leased space and state property is operated, that we do have impacts and work that goes on in communities throughout the state. With that, Mr. Chair and members, that I say that to bring you back to that slide just to underscore the importance of making sure that our base budget remains healthy and that we're able to continue providing those core services. So, Mr. Chair and members, turning to the second recommendation, which is in total, our recommendations, the governor's recommendations, are just under $3.5 million for the biennium. About $1 million of that is one-time recommendations. And so I'll start, Mr. Chair and members, with the proposal for equity in public contracting in veterans, minority, and women-owned business area. This recommendation is for $1.233 million in the biennium, $210,000 of which is a one-time ask related to IT services. We have a number of proposals that are contained in this this package, all directed at both making the current preference programs more efficient, streamlined, and also more effective. To start, Mr. Chair and members, we want to move forward with a quality, effective, and broad implementation of the state certification of veteran-owned small businesses. Certainly, veterans who have served their country and are returning to Minnesota with a great deal of skills and are looking to pursue businesses and economic success here in the state, we want to make sure that we have an effective program in place to have those businesses become certified so that they can pursue targeted group preference programs through the state procurement process. As you may know, Last session, the legislature enacted the authority to move forward, but we did not have the resources to do that. And so we want to continue working closely with the Department of Veterans Affairs and also with yourselves to hopefully make sure that that program is fully funded on an ongoing basis, and that is part of this recommendation. In addition, Mr. Chair and members, we have 900 businesses that are currently certified in the state through the existing preference programs. That includes minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, economically disadvantaged businesses from economically disadvantaged counties in the state, of which there are 40 in Greater Minnesota, and also companies that are owned by disabled individuals that qualify for preference programs. What we want to do, Mr. Chair, members, right now, if you are a minority or a woman-owned business in particular, you may be pursuing three different certifications in the state: a federal certification, a state certification, and a local certification. And what we want to do is to align the state and federal criteria, not so much the federal process, as frankly we believe the federal process is and can be more cumbersome than we would like it to be, but to align the federal criteria in a way that allows us to simplify the registration process, which is an important first step for businesses to pursue state procurement. So what that would allow us to do is to have about 20% of businesses who would automatically become certified because they are federally certified, and then all businesses would be able to better understand the criteria that we're going to use without having to learn the two programs. And most importantly, we would pursue a centralized web-based portal for any companies that are pursuing state or federal certification. In addition to that, Mr. Chair and members, the FTE that you see both for the veterans program and for this entire initiative, one of the things that I can't emphasize enough that I hear from small businesses, from the targeted group businesses that we are wanting to help through this program, that is most lacking, I think, in our ability to help them out right now is the opportunity to do more data analysis, more data review, more accountability, and more outreach, in particular more outreach to these businesses. Right now, the state procurement process, as you might imagine, is always, it's a little bit more understandable to companies who have used it most often and have used it successfully. And so when we're working with small businesses and especially companies that might be pursuing the procurement process for the first time, we want to be able to do a better job of being out, doing outreach and education for all businesses across the state so that they have more opportunity to understand how the procurement process works. So, Mr. Chair and members, and then as a final piece of this, we'll also be collaborating with the Department of Human Rights and other agencies to look for opportunities where we can apply a little bit more broadly state preference programs, subcontracting goals, and hiring goals to largely state-funded projects where those goals and might not apply right now. Oftentimes there's money, for example, in the bonding appropriation bills that is granted out to non-state entities, and currently goals and hiring programs do not apply to those programs if the money's not actually expended by a state agency. Mr. Chair, members, moving along, that brings us to the SMART expansion. This is a program that has been highly successful over a number of years and very well received across state government. It is called the Small Agency Resource Team. The SMART program provides transactional human resource and financial management procurement support for small agencies, boards, and commissions to make sure that those services are provided efficiently, effectively, and to allow those entities to focus on their core missions and make sure, I think one of the real values in this is not only to allow those entities to focus on their core missions, but also to make sure the expertise for those roles that might not be as central or as in terms of the capacity of these agencies to make sure that it's done consistent with the guidelines and the protocols that frankly help help things, the train keep on the tracks and help keep you out of trouble, frankly, and do things the correct way. So it's been a very well-received program, and we hope to expand it to more agencies in cooperation with Minnesota Management and Budget.
And Mr. Mosman, on the back side of that recommendation, you have those small agencies, boards, and councils, which are now being served by SMART. And you shared with us, and I'm sure we'll see them later, but there are a pretty good list of potential SMART candidates that could be served.
It's a pretty good list.
Is there not?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. It is a pretty good list, and what we like to do oftentimes, it's probably a larger list than we can fully support, even with the ask that we have here. And what often happens, what typically has been the case, is if we're able to garner some additional resources towards this effort, we like to have a sit down with agencies and just, you know, there tends to be who is most in need of the services and make some educated choices along those lines. It's not so much a first come, first serve as it is trying to make sure that it's best targeted.
Very good. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Mosman had a report given to us by the OLA and briefed to us regarding some of the agencies that are on the back. That report, does that have any effect on you as far as your FTEs and the number of people or the people that are working with these small agencies that are listed on the back of this here?
Mr. Mosman.
The OLA.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm not immediately familiar with what OLA report you're referring to, but my guess is probably not. The current resources that we get from the general fund that we use to help support these agencies, we essentially use those resources to provide human resource, financial management, transactional support to these agencies. Currently, I think that would continue, but I'm not exactly familiar with the report that you're referring to or the findings. I'd be happy to look into it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Mosman, in the OLA report, it was reported that some of the agencies listed here that you serve on the backside, it's mentioned here, the Council on Black Minnesotans, Chicano Latino Affairs, Indian Affairs Council, and so forth and so on. These individuals, according to the OLA, these groups, according to what the legislative auditor said, was that the amount of money that was being given to them and then the requirements or the things that they were supposed to be doing were lacking in their ability to meet the guidelines that they have in place for them to fulfill and perform. And I'm just wondering if you had anything along with that as far as you're helping them out. I can't remember if the OLA mentioned any type of technical services or anything as far as administration working with them and trying to meet their goals.
Mr. Mosman, if you don't recall right now, perhaps you could get back to the committee here.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I will certainly take a look at it. I'm not aware of there being any concern with regard to the human resource and financial concerns. I think the question you're asking actually goes exactly to the point of how the SMART program is most useful and helpful. The particular entities that you're talking about obviously have missions and responsibilities that they're expected to act on with a fairly, frankly, a pretty small set of professional staff in most cases. And so what we provide is the opportunity for them to not have to be their own human resource and their own financial management staff. But we don't really participate in the substantive and the content-related work that those entities or these small boards and commissions are responsible for.
Thank you.
Senator George Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I am curious about the human resources capacity and opportunity in your agency. I am aware of the complexity of having to work on some HR provisions from your end, and then, you know, for instance, the Department of Human Services has a huge HR division that works on the hiring process and advertising. And I wonder how is the connection working now, and if you could give me a little bit of how that works, and whether or not you see an opportunity for us to figure out how do we help the state look into our workforce for the future. I understand that some organizations really have a challenge recruiting certain individuals, and then others are able to recruit and they retain for a very short period of time, and then people go because we don't have competitive salaries. And that is particularly true in the IT, you know, kind of areas, or where we have large competitors in the private sector, and they are offer better salaries, and then we end up training a lot of people, but then they leave. So there's a cost associated with that. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit. I'm very interested in figuring out how do we work with you to kind of assess our capacity, because we have an aging working force, and then we're competing with businesses that have the same situation. So how do we go about hiring and retaining and offering competitive salaries and not training for other sectors? If you could help us a little bit understand. I know that's probably a hearing on its own, but I was curious about some of the direction that you think we need to take in that regard.
Commissioner Mosman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, thank you for the question. As an agency manager, I certainly share all of the concerns that you lay out. The Department of Administration is actually one of the, on average, oldest state agencies in state government. And so I think as generations of state workforce age, we certainly, I think, as managers, all have those concerns. I think it's important for me to take the opportunity to clarify that even as we talk about this small agency resource team and this program where the Department of Administration helps support small agency boards and commissions, the responsibility and the role of enterprise human resources in terms of helping to facilitate best practices and the overall conversation about human resources in state government is housed at the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. So that's not housed at the Department of Administration.
Very good. Continue, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members, the next recommendation is really the remainder. I said about $1 million was one-time, $210,000 I talked about as part of the IT ask for the targeted group businesses. This next $800,000, $735,000 in 1 year and $65,000 in fiscal 17 for the required periodic disparity study. This recommendation of the governor's relates to the targeted group business programs for minority and women-owned businesses in a very important way, and that is that the basis and the substantiation for these programs, given the legal basis, requires that we periodically review and conduct disparities analysis to determine whether or not there are ongoing disparities, which we would certainly hope over time that we eliminate them. That's the objective of the program. But in order to maintain a legal basis for the programs and substantiate their existence in state law, the state periodically must complete a disparity study. And we have traditionally tried to do that about every 5 years. The last study was completed, initiated in 2008.
Good. So that's over. It's kind of overdue. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mosman, in the guidelines, it says here that this will allow the state to pay up to 6% more for goods, services, construction, and consultants in order to use previously underutilized minority and female-owned businesses. Would that also include veterans?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, that is correct. The veterans, the preferences for the veterans program is also up to 6%.
Thank you. I just doesn't say that, so I'm just concerned that we sometimes we put in words and then we don't cover all our bases.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the disparity analysis pertains primarily to minority and women-owned businesses, but the state preference program, the up to 6%, applies to minority, women-owned businesses, veterans, and also disabled-owned businesses and the economically disadvantaged areas.
Continue, Commissioner Mossman.
So, Mr. Chair and members, that brings us to our final recommendation, which is $144,000 a year, $288,000 for the biennium as part of the Olmsted Implementation Office. The Olmsted Implementation Plan. This is part of what will flow mostly through other committees in the legislative process. This is a piece that the Department of Administration plays an important resource role in as we host the Developmental Disabilities Council, which is a primarily federally funded operation that provides a number of support and advocacy and really needs for that the federal government expects. And this would be a small amount of state resources as the state now has a responsibility and an expectation of moving forward with implementing the Olmsted plan so that there's an additional resource to just help articulate the needs of the community and to provide a bridge in supporting the work that the state agencies are doing and understanding the needs of the community as we are very closely associated with them and the staff of the Developmental Disabilities Council works very closely with them. That, Mr. Chair and members, is the recommendations. I'm happy to stand for any questions now or as you move forward, certainly in the legislative process.
Questions for the Commissioner?
Chairman.
Senator Manson.
Yeah, I want to applaud your department and the Governor for these targeted goals and expectations that you have here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask the question that I always ask, and some of these senators have heard it before, but you have 470 employees or so, and every time around this building, and these are very good programs, okay, let's start by saying that, but every time we ask the department to do something more, they need 8.5 or 11.5 FTEs or 7.5, and my question has always been, Senator Sacksog, is can you cross-train some of these people? Let's start by saying this is very important stuff, and I understand it. But are there people capable of doing these things in your department, in your employment ranks today? Does that make sense? It looks like you need 11.5 more people per year, right?
Senator Metzen, I greatly appreciate the question. I really do, because we are going to make, and I believe do make, every effort to be as efficient as possible in the department. It is my understanding that this program did historically have about 3 FTE that worked on it. Currently, we have essentially less than 1 FTE that works on the certification program and the targeted group business program, which essentially means that we primarily just administer the certification without doing any work on the outreach, a limited amount to be able to follow the data analysis that would really support accountability and making sure the program is working effectively. So to the point, I want to underscore that really a key piece of this is we actually are trying to really take a look as well from the standpoint of the businesses that we're wanting to have certified. This program primarily works if we can get more businesses to certify and become eligible and then pursue and win state procurement contracts. And to that end, that's one of the really primary reasons why we started off with looking at this really complicated federal program, the state program, and trying to simplify the two programs in a way that we hope makes it easier for businesses. But I appreciate the question.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I think, Mr. Chairman and members, maybe streamlining some of these efforts, maybe there will be savings along the way, too. So, you know, and if we could move ahead on some of these areas, it would be very helpful for minority groups and veterans and people we talked about. We'll see.
Absolutely.
Senator Anderson, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mossman, I've had people from my district concerned about the Olmstead Act, and I see that you have a proposal on the item assisting in tracking the key Olmstead plan results and report to the U.S. District Court, including. And I'm just wondering, is there a report being done on the Olmstead plan by your office or not?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I am not going to be an expert on the full Olmstead implementation plan, but my understanding is that in the current layout now with the sub-cabinet that the governor has created through executive order with the Olmstead implementation plan, that the office of Olmstead implementation, currently housed at Deed, that the governor is proposing would be housed at Housing Finance, would take the lead on making those reports to the court monitor.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Mr. Mossman, you're working with the other departments and with this Olmstead plan to go forward. You haven't been working with them in the past?
Commissioner Mossman.
It's a little tricky, Mr. Chair, but to some extent, from a separation standpoint, historically, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, which is comes out of federal law, I believe every state has one, is housed at the Department of Administration such that it be, frankly, separated from some of the other entities in state government that play a role in providing services to the developmentally disabled. And so the Department of Administration hosts the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and its staff, which is really a key stakeholder group in the conversation around the Olmstead Implementation Office, understanding the needs of disabled individuals and understanding what expectations, what state agencies need to do in order to meet those needs. So we have, I don't know off the top of my head, but I believe it's approximately three FTE. It's a small staff that works on, that's almost exclusively federally funded right now. What this would do would be, but they have a focus around the federal responsibilities. What this would do as part of the state and state agencies needing to move forward with implementation of the Olmstead plan, provide some additional resource in working with the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and those stakeholders to help make sure that those needs are being met and translated and communicated effectively within state government.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anders.
Mr. Mossman, I'm kind of piggybacking on what Senator Metzen was just saying. Utilizing those people over in the Disability Council and using their expertise supposedly in the Olmstead plan, you're looking here for more assistance to help there, and looking like you're wanting to have more FTEs or at least another FTE to help. I'm just wondering why we can't, you know, just have one agency involved rather than you got three agencies and you're trying to keep them separated, and it seems like nobody wants to talk to anybody, and yet you're forced to by law, and yet it doesn't happen. And that's a concern of mine, because I get people from my area who try to go to the social services, and they say, this Olmstead Act is supposed to be working, and it's not working, and then they point fingers at my local county, and then they point back at the state, and the state goes, oh, it's the federal. So it just, to me, it seems like we're building a group over here, a silo over here, and there's a silo over here, and there's another one over here, and nobody's communicating, and it's all trying to supposed to be come together because statute said it's supposed to work together.
And Senator Anderson, I guess I'd say these are the governor's and the commissioner's
I'm trying to figure out how he's going to get this all together.
Yeah, well, I know, but this isn't necessarily the Senate. So your discussion and Senator Metzen's are well-founded, and I'm sure it won't be the last time we discuss this particular.
And, Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could, because I greatly appreciate the point you're making. In fact, folks in my department would know how much I've talked internally about needing to eliminate silos. I'll double-check and get back to you, but I believe that this particular situation, which does occasionally happen, stems out of an expectation or requirement of federal law that there actually be some separation. But I will I'll double-check that and get back to you.
Other questions? Thank you, Commissioner Mossman and Mr. Scherer.
Mr. Chair.
Next, we have presentation by MNIT. Minute. We have a couple of handouts that will be going out. Mr. Tom Baden, and are you going to be joined by Mr. Eichten?
By Mr. Eichten, sir.
Okay. John Eichten, legislative director. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's my first time here. It's a pleasure to meet you all, and looking forward to working with you here for a long time to come. While I'm only a couple of weeks into the job, been around for a couple of cups of coffee. Been around here working around state government for 33 years and worked in many different agencies, many different lines of business, and just very, very privileged to be in this position, and thank you for having me here today.
Well, welcome, Mr. Baden. We'll look forward to talking with you more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd like to start by just providing, again, a little bit of context about MNIT and just a little bit of history, but out of respect for your time, I'm going to move through that pretty quickly and get right to the business at hand, and with your permission, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. First off, Minute Services is the information technology instrument for everybody in the state, the 26 branch agencies. We provide the full spectrum of information technology, responsible for all of the applications, middleware, databases, networks, the entire infrastructure that the state runs on, Minute is responsible for. We also provide some of our services for other Minnesota government agencies, some local and county, as well as higher education. Our role is to provide leadership and direction for consolidation, but also starting to change that conversation to a unified technical presence of leveraging all the assets we have around the state to deliver information technology as an instrument for our agencies. We also provide standards and oversight, application lifecycle management, systems operations, security management, and the IT project portfolio, which I got for the first time the other day. We have literally all of our information technology projects in one place, and I can look at them all in one spot for the first time. A little bit of look back from 2011 is that 2011, you passed consolidation legislation, which started us down this path together. It was a full consolidation of all IT for the executive branch, and that included all the people, the infrastructure, the applications and projects for the state, essentially all things IT. It included the transfer of authority for all people and dollars, and that was on a pretty tight time frame, 10 weeks. That was accomplished. All the basic mechanics of moving all of the IT staff and moving all of the IT funds was all accomplished in that short period of time with no dollars attached. We did that all. I experienced that from the agency side of the fence, and we did it all with rolling up our sleeves and working hard. That came along with legislative expectations, and that's in terms of efficiencies and alignment of those resources and those assets and the IT portfolios to really not only manage costs and become operationally very strong, but also look for opportunities to save in costs, leverage assets, but also look for areas that we can combine forces to be a more effective government. All of those efforts are managed through a service level agreement with each agency. Each agency, and I know mine from the Department of Human Services, was about this big. I got the kerplunk of all of those people, budget, and technologies every quarter, updated, met with the agency once a quarter and went through and went. It also had performance measures. How are we doing? Are we delivering the services that we've said that we were going to deliver on time, on budget, all of those types of discussions? That service level agreement is really one of those primary instruments. We also established a technology advisory committee. We're not going at this without the advice of our agency. In fact, I talked with John this morning, and I reached out and I said, when's our first meeting with the technology advisory committee? We're putting that on the schedule. I don't know if we got that on the schedule today or not, but hopefully tomorrow. It's to me, the partnership with our agencies and the partnership with the IT, the service delivery that we provide for the agencies, if we're not in just very, very tight partnership with our agencies, there's not a chance for us to succeed. So that technology advisory is very important to me. Where are we at today? Minute Services today is about 2,100 employees, 22 agency-based offices. In fact, actually, we've got IT spread all over greater Minnesota in many hundreds of locations above that. More than 2,000 distinct applications and a combined biannual operating budget of $850 million. That $850 million is the employment or the financial model that we have. 99% of that budget is covered by state agencies procuring IT goods and services from Minute. State agencies can receive federal funding. They can receive state funding. They can receive fundings from grants, from fees, from those type of activities. The state agency then procures information technology from Minute. Minute has a rate-based model of which they charge them back for that technology, and that's managed through the mechanism of the service level agreement. Pretty straightforward. I wish it was straightforward to manage on a day-to-day basis, but the model is pretty straightforward. And that really leads us, by the way, one last thing. One key milestone that we accomplished here just very recently is now all information technology procurements are done through central IT procurement, which really leads us to why I'm here today. We have two primary requests that we're here to talk about. The first change item is really technical in nature, and it's really to ask the renewal of what we call a rotating fund. We have a rotating fund where if we're providing an IT service to an agency, Minute has to buy people, software, hardware, infrastructure, those type of things. We bill the agency back for that service, and there's a time frame that it takes to provide that goods or service, bill it back to the agency, and then have the agency reimburse Minute for those goods and service. This revolving fund is essentially the cash flow that we need to fully operate and accomplish IT consolidation. So one of our key asks is that we renew that process. There's one other subset of this that we're also asking for, and that's an adjustment of the date. Our fiscal year runs all the way through until June 30th, and what we'd like to do is have a reasonable accommodation so that agencies can buy IT up until the end of that month, and we've got a normal time period where we can send the agency the bill for something that was bought on June 28th. The agency can process and do its due diligence in reviewing the bill. They can pay us for that was accomplished before the end of the fiscal year, and we can tie up our end of the year fiscal. So we're asking for that adjustment to give us essentially a usual time period that we would need for an agency to respond and get that back in. And it puts us on much more of a fiscal synchronicity with the agent. We're with the agency. And that's primarily our number one request of the group here today. Any questions about that particular ask?
I guess we think that
it makes some
sense.
There's no net effect to the budget. You know, we're totally rate-based. We're a not-for-profit agency. Whatever we charge, we get paid back for, and it's a net zero at the end of the day.
Very good.
Make sense?
We have any questions from the committee? All right. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned you had hundreds of locations around the state where you deliver the services. Could you just, let's say, take northwestern Minnesota, and now I assume that probably like colleges and universities are probably part of it, and counties, human services offices, things like that. Are there other areas apart from those kind of more obvious government facilities that services are delivered?
Commissioner Bade.
Senator, Mr. Chair, I think in terms of, I was the former CIO from Department of Human Services, we had 250 locations. And you are correct in assuming that it's counties, it's universities, it's VA medical centers, it's also boards and commissions and areas, call centers that are not located in the metro. It's literally the entire MNNet, which is the network that hooks them all together, as well as the locations that it serves.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much for coming and your good presentation.
Sir, I've got one more item, Mr. Chair.
Go for it, Commissioner.
That's really a 1.8% increase due to the collective bargaining agreement for the staff that are directly covered in direct financial allocation. 99% of our budget is rate-based and charged back to entities that pay a rate for the services they consume. 1% is a direct allocation, and that includes the IT leadership to accomplish this IT consolidation, CIO's office, et cetera, information technology security leadership and cyber support, which includes the actions that we do on behalf of higher education and many counties and local municipalities as well as the geospatial office, which is the instrumentation and the people that provide you with the ability to look at data and geographic locations to make decisions based on geospatial information.
And the governor was fairly consistent in that recommendation to all his departments. So.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anything else? Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Next, we have the presentation by the Board of Cosmetology. Gina Stoss.
Oh, wait, cosmetology.
Director Stoss, welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Yep, I've been here a few times, so thank you again for having me, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gina Stoss-Fast, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners. I've been the director since 2006, and I truly enjoy making a difference in the lives of the board's licensees and the public by advancing our services to provide the best possible infrastructure to promote public protection and efficient services. Thank you for the opportunity today to give you a very brief overview of the Board of Cosmetology, its functions, and the governor's recommendations. The board was founded in 1927. It currently has 7 members on the board, and they're appointed by the governor on 4-year terms. The board employs 14.3 FTEs in 5 divisions of licensing, inspecting, compliance, policy, and administration. The licensing division is responsible to manage over 42,000 licensees, as well as issuing over 3,500 new licenses each year and renewing 12,000 licenses. The inspection division is responsible to inspect all licensed salons, which is approximately 5,500 throughout the state, as well as the schools, to ensure public safety is being met and salons are demonstrating proper sanitation and disinfection practices. the compliance division is responsible to investigate all complaints filed either by the public or the board themselves against cosmetologists, salons, and schools who are violating board's rules that they're empowered to enforce, primarily with licensing infractions as well as safety and sanitation infractions. The policy division is responsible to organize and manage the rulemaking process that includes annual notification of obsolete rules, working with the governor's office, the revisor's office, and other stakeholders for hearings, as well as working through new rules. And the administrative division is responsible to make sure all of these divisions work together and to protect the mission of the to ensure the mission is of protecting the health and safety of the public is happening, as well as to develop strategies and further advancement and innovation. The board is responsible to keep people in Minnesota safe by licensing those that are competent to provide services to avoid injury, disease, and by performing regular inspections. The board supports efficient and accountable government services by evaluating applicant credentials, issuing and renewing qualified applicants, and responding to our licensees within a timely manner. The board receives a direct appropriation from the general fund to cover the cost of the operations of the board. The board's revenue is based on a collection of fees from cosmetology-related licenses. Our current base budget is $1.346 million for fiscal year 2015. The board has appropriated about 70% of its revenues. It's on a three-year license cycle. Therefore, the board receives approximately one-third of its renewal fees per year to sustain operations. Let's see here. And the reason I'm here today is to talk about the 1.8% increase that the governor recommended to cover compensation increases such as insurance, FICA, Medicare, and retirements. If the board was not given this base budget increase, it would result in reduced staffing and operating costs. I'd also like to notify you that the board will likely be proposing an agency bill that would have both a policy and a fiscal impact this session, so you may be seeing me again. I was told to be brief. I hope that was what you were looking for, and I stand for questions, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Good synopsis, Ms. Das. Do we have any questions? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your brevity.
Yep.
Next, we have the Barber Examiner's Board. Executive Director Thora Fisco.
Thank
Director,
you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I was introduced, I'm Thora Fisco, Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. Our role is similar to the Cosmetology Board. Our size is small in comparison. Our board has four members, three barbers and one public member, and we license approximately 3,000 licenses every year, and that's about 2,000 registered or master barbers, 200 apprentice barbers, 100 students, and 900 barber shops. Then we have five barber schools. So we accomplish this with three staff in the office. There's myself, a customer service staff, and an inspector, and our inspector travels around the state to visit those 900 barber shops to make sure that they are functioning in a safe and sanitary manner. The board conducts examinations six times a year to make sure that barbers that we're licensing have the skills and can demonstrate the skills to provide good services and also to do them in a sanitary manner so that we see they're using their instruments properly and keeping them clean and sanitary to keep Minnesotans safe. And I, too, am here in response to the governor's budget and the 1.8 increase that is being recommended so that we can continue our operations.
Just quick, the inspector, he's got 900 barbershops. Does he get around once a year to most of them?
That's always our goal. In reality, it's about once every 18 months.
Okay. Very good. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you said you issue 3,000 licenses per year?
Yeah, correct. We issue and or renew, yes.
And so I'm taking that there's more than, say, one or two barbers in a barbershop that you're...
It can range anywhere.
Fiscal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
anywhere, Senator, from a one-chair barbershop with one barber to 7, 8 or more.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have many out-of-state people coming to Minnesota to be licensed?
Ms. Fisco.
Senator, we do have some. I don't have the numbers, but we do see reciprocity applications on a fairly regular basis where folks who are licensed in another state or even another country are seeking licensure in Minnesota.
And, Mr. Chairman, and what kind, Ms. Fisco, what kind of process or procedure do they have to go through in order to receive a Minnesota license?
Ms. Fisco.
We look to get a verification from their current jurisdiction of licensure, and then we evaluate that jurisdiction's requirements against Minnesota requirements. And if they match up, and the requirements are the same, or they've already met or exceeded those requirements, they can be issued a license. Otherwise, they may need to go to school in Minnesota to make up the difference or take our examination. It really depends on the jurisdiction they're coming from and if those requirements meet our requirements or not.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. And this could apply, I suppose, to cosmetologists too, but do barbers have to go through a background check?
Currently, Senator, currently they do not, and we actually have two barber programs in the correctional facilities.
Senator, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, can a person come in, say, as a veteran who's been doing barbering in the service and come in and take a test, and basically if he passes or she passes the test, become a barber here in Minnesota, or are they required to do more schooling other than what they've already had as far as service-connected or as a veteran?
Ms. Fisco.
Currently, we're actually working on that section of our statute based on last year with the temporary military license. And what we hope to do is someone could come in from the service and obtain a temporary military license so they could practice while they do whatever requirements are necessary for them to prepare to take an exam if that's required. And it would be evaluated, much like I said, with reciprocity. We would look at their training and experience and compare it to the Minnesota requirements as to if they needed to take an exam or not.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Fisco. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yep. And lastly, but not leastly, Sia Herr, how are you? Executive Director, Asian Pacific, Minnesotans Council.
Alrighty. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As most of you have already met with me, you know that my name is Sia Herr, and I am the executive director at one of the 5 advisory councils. This is the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and to my right is our board chair, Mr. Tran Non. The council, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 3.9226, seeks to advise the legislature and the governor on issues of importance to the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, advocate on behalf of this community, and help to build and maintain reciprocal relationships between this community and state government. Today, our community is estimated to be 260,000 strong, which makes us a little bit less than 5% of the total population. And we descend from over 40 nations. We are the most diverse of the racial groups here in the state of Minnesota. Our 5 largest communities are the Hmong, the Asian Indians, the Chinese, the Korean, and the Vietnamese. As many of you may already know, I became executive director of the council in March of 2013. Since my time on board, the council has repositioned itself to more effectively assist you, the governor, and our communities. Now, as executive director, I do not believe that I live in a vacuum. Our council does not believe that it lives in a vacuum. We are aware that the role and the structure of all of our ethnic councils will be debated in the upcoming legislative sessions. We expect that we will be debated during this legislative session. I am appreciative of the opportunity to be here before all of you to speak on behalf of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and especially as it relates to the governor's change item recommendation. We at the council believe that we as a council are important to our communities. The work that this council does and is doing increasingly better is giving our communities a reason to believe that they can continue to move toward full equal status as Minnesotans and as Americans. When this council fulfills its roles as advisor, advocate, and bridge, we contribute to our community's capacity to directly engage and negotiate our own involvement in the political process. You may now already know that we have an operating budget of $354,000 during this current biennium. That affords us a staff team of four FTEs. With this capacity during this biennium, our council has focused on four goals. Our first goal is to support the mission we were created to serve by developing projects that are aligned with Minnesota Statute 3.9226. Toward this end, we've hosted meetings which strengthened community and legislative connections. For example, in 2014, and then just up until a month ago, we orchestrated four trainings for almost 200 community members. The trainings were designed to increase our community's capacity to interact directly with legislators, both outside of and within the legislative process. We've hosted four major community events, including a 2014 legislative session recap, which brought together community and policymakers face-to-face for conversations on and about the issues of the day. We've enhanced our council's role as a liaison for legislative changes by being more present in our communities and, as many of you know, here at the Capitol. In 2014 alone, we attended at least 47 community events in the seven metro areas and in greater Minnesota. And when you do the math, that works out to be about four events per month for a staff of four FTEs. We've produced an original community issues report on the subject of early childhood education access as it relates to our Southeast Asian Minnesotan communities. We will begin implementation of a tiered release process in early March to share with stakeholders our findings. Our second goal is to support and advance legislation on behalf of our community. Beginning with the 2014 legislative session, we have sought community input, and we've established community-informed legislative agendas. With these priorities in mind, in 2014 and this year, we've testified in committees, written letters, and we've visited with legislators. We've also engaged our community members in efforts to influence legislation. For example, last year we introduced a bill related to gender-based violence in the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. In doing so, our council created a platform upon which we helped to raise the voices of some of the most vulnerable members of our community. This year, we will introduce two bills on this subject matter again. Our third goal is to actively engage key stakeholders. To this end, we have built and maintained strategic partnerships with our community-based organizations, the governor's office, and, of course, with the state legislature. We've maintained our council's presence in our communities, especially in our emerging refugee communities such as the Karen. Now, this is especially critical to Minnesota because Minnesota is quite unique. It has now become home to the largest concentration of this ethnic group from Burma. Finally, and of keen interest to you, our funders to whom we are accountable, we have strengthened and streamlined internal administrative activities to ensure more effective operations. Toward this end, we have developed policies and procedures to support and maintain consistent board practices for the purpose of ensuring more effective governance. We've worked closely with the governor's office to bring board representation closer to full compliance as mandated in our enabling statute. We've developed stable and relevant community communication strategies. In addition to communicating via social media and emails, what we've done at the council is we've engaged community-based organizations. And by that, I'm talking about the fact that we've invited and we've had monthly presentations by these community-based organizations at our board meetings. We've also presented to organizational and cultural groups on the council's role and responsibilities using what we call the Council 101 presentation. So I'm here today to request that as you are considering an adjustment to our budget, I hope that you will continue to pay attention to our communities, especially to the communities within our community who may not be able to communicate with you as easily as we would all like to have them be able to. I believe that, again, one significant improvement in our council in the past 2 years since I've been here has been that the doorway into our communities for legislators has been opened in a way that is creating new opportunities for real, meaningful interactions. Many members of our communities are seeing state and county government in a new light, and many legislators have pointedly stated that they appreciate seeing the real workings of our communities. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Mr. Tran and I look forward to coming before the committee again.
Thank you, Ms. Sir. Do we have any questions? Well laid out presentation. Thank you very much. We appreciate you both. Thank you, sir, for joining us. All right, Senator Torres-Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let the members know, because I think we have some overlap with members, but not a lot. So I just wanted to let members know that we are working. There are several members in the Senate who are very interested in drafting some changes to the legislation that governs the councils, and the chair is aware of this effort. So we've made significant progress to really outline the responsibilities and the outcomes that we expect out of, you know, these interactions with the communities, and we know that they do significant work to connect us with communities of color in the American Indian community. But we do have a report that came out of the legislative auditor that says, you know, we need to integrate our work into the work that they do and vice versa. We need to have more measurable outcomes in terms of what it means to meet with the community and get input. The language that is in legislation really talks about, you know, get input, provide advice. So those are very vague words. And at the end, you know, how many people do you have to meet to get input? And what is advice? And what is a recommendation? So the staff has been very diligent to help us figure out what governs, you know, each, they're reviewing each statute that governs each agency, figuring out what the legislative auditor report says about these issues of accountability, governance. And we are very close to creating a bill that will come before my committee first, and then it will come to you. So we're very excited about that and wanted to give you an update.
Senator, we're happy to hear that, and I guess my only comment is that we can set up a set of recommendations for all four bodies, but they're all a little different. So, and you know that, though, so I have to tell you that. So, any other questions? Okay, so members, I think we're going to meet again this coming Wednesday. We made great progress today. On Wednesday, I think we'll hear from the MMB, Department of Revenue, Legislative Auditor. We've talked about him already today. The Historical Society, Board of Accountancy, Board of Architectural Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Internal Design. And then the Indian Affairs Council. So Mr. look Chair. Forward to that. Yes, Senator Anderson.
How many hours is that going to take?
Well, I really do think that with the progress, as we looked and saw with questions what happened today, I think we'll do that in our hour and a half. And if we don't, we'll meet again. I assure you.
I'm sure you will.
All right. Good. Any other for the good of the committee? If not, means adjourned.